Good morning. Very good to see you all. Thank you for coming. I'm Gloria Rhodes, and I chair the Applied Social Sciences Department. And my department, together with Bible and Religion and the Language and Literature departments, regularly hosts something called the C. Henry Smith Oratorical Contest. This is a yearly contest that was established in 1974 by the directors of the C. Henry Smith Trust as a way of honoring him. He is a late Mennonite historian who taught at Goshen College and at Bluffton University. He was well known for a lot of books on Mennonite history, and his particular interest was in peace commitments of the Mennonite tradition. This contest is administered every year by the Peace and Justice Ministries of the Mennonite Central Committee, and students from every Mennonite and every Brethren in Christ school, college, in North America and in Canada are eligible, and regularly they do draw from most of those colleges and universities. EMU has participated in this event for, we had participated for many years, starting in 1974, and then we kind of lapsed, and we picked it back up again due to the good graces of Nancy Heise in 2003, and we're very proud of our tradition since then. We've had students win the grand prize at the bi-national level, so once we have eight students competing this week here at EMU. The winner of this one will go to the bi-national competition. And again, we're proud of our students. We've won the grand prize at the bi-national level for five times, 2003, 2004, 2007, 2009, and 2011. No pressure. It seems like it's about time. I'm happy to introduce you to this year's contestants. They have each applied a Christian peace position in whatever way they wanted to a contemporary concern, however they wanted to express that. This morning, they're going to give you just a taste of their speech, so a mini speech, in hope that you'll join us this Friday evening, beginning at 7 o'clock in Martin Chapel, to hear the whole thing. Speeches today are timed at 2 minutes. Speeches on Friday should be no more than 10 minutes, 10 minutes or less. So again, today they'll be giving you a 2-minute taste. This year's contestants this morning will be speaking in this order. Hannah Chapel Dick, should I give the titles? You won't be able to remember them. I'll give the titles now because they want to jump right in. So Hannah's title is Beyond Fight or Flight, Becoming Mennonite in an Adrenaline-Soaked World. Bethany Chupp, Standing at the Door. Ethan Herman, Active Pacifism and Using Conflict as a Tool. Katrina Poplett, To Be at War with Yourself. Grantley Showalter, The Wisdom of Doubt. Stephanie Toth, speaking about humans and technology. Elizabeth Wilder, Make Change, Not Hashtags. And Ayu Yifru, Fighting Injustice with Love. And then we'll have a final song. So please welcome our dancers and our contestants with me, Hannah.
Hello, my name is Hannah Chapel Dick. I traveled to Kansas City for a convention last year as a delegate for First Mennonite Church of Bluffton, Ohio. We are living in a time of transformation, but Mennonites aren't known for moving quickly. Sitting with my table group, we listened to some poured out their fear and lament that this would be their last convention with MCUSA, as their congregations were pulled apart by impending policy changes. We experienced these emotions in a group, learning together, feeling the palpable pain, and not turning away. I'll never forget the words given to me by my table leader, Karen, at the end of a long, hard week of discernment over the resolutions. Hannah, she said, I know we're slow, but please don't give up on us. We need young people's voices more than ever right now. We cried together. Many of us cried as we walked through the reality of separation and pain within the church. My heart swelled with hope by the end, though, because even in the midst of massive changes, bridges were still being built. When I went home, however, I realized what a disconnect there was between the feelings of hope and progress that many of the delegates felt and the feelings of despair from the people watching the updates of failing resolutions unfolding through social media. Is this the end of the Mennonite church? I was asked more than once. With so many tears and the possibility of torn congregations, it could have felt like an ending, except that it didn't. The experience of convention truly and deeply changed me. I remember that my phone was blinking in my bag with angry posts on Facebook from both conservative and liberal Mennonites. But that week and for many weeks following, I couldn't bear to read them. I couldn't explain what I felt in my heart. I couldn't type a pithy response and share it. I didn't even have a picture that could come close to sharing what I had experienced with all these people. This was the week when I decided to stick with the Mennonite Church. I'd like to offer three suggestions for what we young adults might gain from maintaining connection with the Mennonite Church in this adrenaline-soaked world on Friday.
I'm sitting in a small classroom in the middle of Beit Sahur, Palestine. It's week three since we left the United States, and there are 3 months remaining. We are flooded with the stories of Palestinians living under Israeli occupation. We are caught up and overwhelmed in waves of violence, a seemingly endless cycle. Some days, it feels like we're drowning. On this particular day, a Palestinian man shares his story of oppression, the family members he has lost over the years, the sense of fear he experiences almost daily. When he finishes his story, we inquire, "So what message should we take back home to our friends and family? What do you want us to remember?" We've asked this question innumerable times. It has been one small way that we attempt to make some sense of all we are being told. But his answer gives us pause. "Whatever you do," he says, "don't pick one side over the other. Don't pick us over them, and don't pick them over us. We're doing that enough ourselves already." Psalms 27:14 reads, "Wait for the Lord. Be strong and take heart and wait for the Lord." The Hebrew translation of this verse uses the word kava for the idea of waiting. Kava means two things. First, to wait, look for, hope, and expect. However, it also means to collect or to bind together. Kava is an active way of waiting. It is not passively waiting for things to happen. It is a way to participate by holding space in anticipation of things to come.
Hi, guys. My name is Ethan Herman, and I'm going to be speaking on active pacifism and using conflict as a tool to achieve pacifistic goals. So pacifism itself is a fairly broad concept, especially here, even in the Mennonite community. There are many different people who see it in many different ways and act upon it very differently. And coming from a very, very, very conservative hometown in which pacifism is not only not something you see a lot, but something frowned upon, something that people are afraid of, it's very different coming somewhere like here where pacifism sometimes seems like a requirement or something that everyone must be or do. So as opposed to just being a said requirement that people must meet, I am going to be talking about active pacifism, a way of seeing pacifism as not something you have to do, or something you can do, or something that goes beyond just saying, "Oh, I like peace, I don't like war," or, "Oh, I just want to be friendly to people," but actually working towards that peace, using love as a tool, as a weapon, and using conflict and seeing ways you can use conflict as a tool to achieving the peace, to achieving true pacifism. So come on Friday, and it should be a good time. Thank you.
I know this isn't the answer, but hear me out. I am uncomfortable in my skin because sometimes I know it symbolizes oppression and privilege. I know that my ancestors did not value different colored people as precious human lives. I know that my skin allows me to benefit from poverty and a system of discrimination. My skin represents, to an extent, the system that I criticize so freely. The ironic thing is, though, I can criticize this system because I am white, because people don't see my criticisms as an act of terrorism or a radical statement. As beings of white skin, Our privilege is so vastly built into our way of life and thinking that even attempting to recognize all instances of privilege due to skin color is impossible. If you share my skin color, you're probably feeling guilty or ashamed of your skin color. I've struggled with this feeling because I know that I am listened to and given more opportunities than other people of color. I know that my skin is a large part of why I feel safe. My skin color has shaped my entire life. I feel guilt for how my ancestors treated people. I feel guilty for how whites forced the indigenous people off of their lands and into reservations. I feel guilty from benefiting from slavery. I feel guilt for not looking at every person I've met with equal amounts of respect and an open mind. I feel guilt for not listening more. But this guilt isn't the answer. I've spent time paralyzed with this. I didn't know what to do or how to even begin to address a clearly systematic and personal problem. I'm not angry that I feel this. I'm not upset or frustrated or disheartened that I feel guilt, because I am at war with myself. Guilt is just a way of how I have processed my skin color. It isn't necessary for every person, but it's part of my story. I'm not ashamed of my skin color now. Guilt and shame are two very different things, and I have come to the understanding with myself that I am not ashamed to be white.
At summer camp, I had a lot of fun playing with my friends, hiking, canoeing, and enjoying the camp activities. On the last night, as per usual, we sat around the campfire and asked the speaker, as the speaker gave a rousing session about coming to God and turning from sin. The camp counselors and the other campers got into groups and started to pray. I wasn't sure about what this God thing was, and I wasn't sure if I believed it was true. I wanted to join my friends in the prayer circle, but I couldn't shake these doubts hovering in the back of my head. Was God real? Did God actually care about me? I went over to the speaker to share my doubts and questions with him. He was taken a little off guard, and after listening to me for a beat, began to pray. He prayed that God would take these doubts away and that Satan would not be able to plant these seeds in my head. When he was done praying, he looked at me and said, "Grantley, true faith means believing even when you don't understand." My 13-year-old brain took special note of this. The church is not a safe place to express doubts. Over the past decade or so, a trend of young people leaving the church has developed. This has caused much anxiety among leaders in the church. People have spent time and energy trying to understand why this phenomenon is happening this way. This has affected the way many Christian communities have viewed questions and doubts directed at traditional beliefs. Often, questions about God, right or wrong, are seen as the first step towards turning from tradition and are met with suspicion and misgivings. In my growing up years, I was taught to believe without understanding. This was seen as the best way to develop faith and spirituality. This fear of questioning has created a dangerous environment where young people no longer feel safe to express their doubts in developing in their spiritual journey in an honest way. Stories like Job in the Bible exemplify how deep questioning about spiritual elements of life define a path towards wisdom. Questioning God and even God's existence is not a sign of spiritual weakness, but instead a sign of growing wisdom.
From the first cave painting to the printing press, from the telephone to the telegraph, from the first dial-up computers to now smartphones, our technology changes the way in which we communicate, and it's advancing fast. British television anthology series Black Mirror features speculative fiction with dark and sometimes satirical themes of life and technology. It taps into the unease about our modern world. In one episode, the entire history of you, almost everyone has an implant that allows them to replay everything they see or hear, even displaying it for others to see on TV screens. The main character, Liam Foxwell, grows suspicious over his wife's behavior around an old friend, and in replay, proves to her that her story of him is full of lies. A one-week fling in her youth becomes a one-month fling, becomes a serious six-month relationship. He discovers through this technology that his child is not his, and the episode ends with Liam walking around his empty house, replaying happier times with his wife. Now you're thinking, this is a fictional TV show. What does this have to do with today? And you're right. I mean, we were promised hoverboards, jetpacks, and flying cars and have none of those yet. However, the creator of Black Mirror, Charlie Broker, notes, each episode has a different cast, a different setting, even reality, but they're all about the way we live now and the way we might be living in 10 minutes if we're clumsy. So let's talk about today and what today's technology could mean for our future and for the future of peace building. Thank you.
It's easier for me to accept the fact there is a shooting in my hometown than to believe that we're still refusing to take gun control seriously. On February 25th, 2016, my safe, boring, small hometown of Heston, Kansas got the rude awakening of a lifetime when a disgruntled man chose to take out his pain and agony on the employees of XL Industries. This poor, broken human with a history of violence obtained an AK-47 and a Glock, making the decision to use violence to solve his problems. In his terror, the man took the lives of 3 employees and wounded 14 others. The violence ended with more violence as our town police chief made the seemingly only choice to kill the gunman to stop the massacre. Reality has finally set in Heston, Kansas. Mass shootings have become so common that even the supposed safe Mennonite haven could not remain untouched. And though I am overwhelmingly proud of the outpouring of love, grace, and support that I witnessed in my community, it, quite frankly, isn't enough. Because this isn't a rare occurrence, and Heston isn't alone in their pain. Thank you.
It's been good to hear a collection of voices. There's voices for peace, and dancing for peace, and singing for peace. That sounds soft, lofty, easy for some of us to say, hard for others. It's really about justice, right? That word's a little more gritty, calls us to dig in. And I think Friday evening we'll be digging in, right? Deeper. So 7 p.m. at Martin Chapel to hear the full speeches. Join me in prayer. God, as we bring our gathered time to a close, may we be impacted by the voices that we've heard this morning, encouraged, invited, challenged, disturbed, engaged, to seek your truth, to seek your way, and speaking into and living into just living with the goal of peace, wholeness, shalom. We know it's a vision, we know it's lofty, but we also know it resonates with your kingdom values, with the very teaching and person and divinity of Jesus. And so may we open our hearts that we all may be active in this work, your work, for peace. Amen. Go with this vision.